Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you and all of the Kellys, and Happy New Year coming up, of course.
Yes, thank you. Well, tonight we agreed to talk about the city of Detroit, a cautionary tale, a lab experiment, a dysfunction, collapse, you could say, in the city of Detroit. Well, what can we say about Detroit? Well, history of course. Detroit is the largest and most populous city in the U.S. state of Michigan, the largest American city in the United States, on the United States-Canada border. The municipality of Detroit had a 2018 estimated population of 672,662, making it the 23rd most populous city in the United States. The metropolitan area, known as Metro Detroit, is home to 4.3 million people, making it the second largest in the Midwest after the Chicago metropolitan area. Regarded as a major cultural center, Detroit is known for its contributions to music and as a repository for art, architecture, and design. Detroit is a major port on the Detroit River, one of the four major straits that connect the Great Lakes system to the St. Lawrence Seaway. The Detroit Metropolitan Airport is among the most important hubs in the United States. The city of Detroit anchors the second largest regional economy in the Midwest, behind Chicago and ahead of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and is the 13th largest in the United States. Detroit is best known as the center for the U.S. automobile industry and the headquarters of the Big Three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, which from here aren't so big anymore, but it's another story, or at least related story. It's history. In 1701, Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac founded Fort Pontchartrain, du Detroit. I guess it's Detroit, right? As the French would pronounce it.
That is perfect, Tim. Yeah. You're like so fluent. It's
Pontchartrain du Detroit, the future city of Detroit. During the 19th century, it became an important industrial hub at the center of the Great Lakes region. The city became the fourth largest in the nation in 1920, only after New York City, Chicago, and Philadelphia, with the influence of the booming auto industry. With the expansion of the auto industry in the early 20th century, the city and its suburbs experienced rapid growth, and by the 1940s, the city had become the fourth largest in the country. However, due to industrial restructuring, loss of jobs in the auto industry, and the rapid suburbanization, Detroit lost considerable population from the late 20th century to the present. Since reaching a peak of 1.85 million at the 1950 census, Detroit's population has declined by more than 60%. In 2013, the city became the largest U.S. city to file for bankruptcy, which it successfully exited in December 2014 when the city government regained control of Detroit's finances. Detroit has been described as a ghost town. Parts of the city are so abandoned that they have been described as urban prairies. The city has become notorious for urban blight. A significant percentage of the housing parcels in the city are vacant, with abandoned lots making up more than half of the total residential lots in large portions of the city. With at least 70,000 abandoned buildings, 31,000 empty houses, and 90,000 vacant lots. The average price of homes sold in Detroit in 2012 was $7,500. That's not $75,000, that's $7,500. Despite the extremely low price for Detroit's properties, most have been on the market for more than a year as boarded up, abandoned houses of the city are seldom attractive to buyers. The Detroit News reported that more than half of the Detroit property owners did not pay taxes in 2012. At a loss of the city of $131 million, which equals 12% of the city's general fund budget. Along a long and a major, a long major population center, Detroit has been going through a considerable reduction in the population. As I said, the city lost over 60% of its population since 1950. Detroit reached its population peak in 1950 at 1.8 million and decreased population with each subsequent census. As of 2010, the city has just over 700,000 residents. The vast majority of this population loss was due to a phenomenon called white flight, resulting in the movement of many of the white families to the suburbs. As a result, the racial composition of the city changed from being 83.6% white and 16.2% black in 1950 to 10.6% white and 82.7% black in 2010. Approximately 1.4 million of the 1.6 million white people in Detroit after World War II have left the city, with many going to the suburbs. This drastic racial demographic change resulted in much more than a change in neighborhood appearance. It had political, social, economic effect as well. In 1974, Detroit elected its first black mayor, Coleman Young. Coleman Young aimed to create a racially diverse cabinet and police force, half black, half white members, leading to a new face representing Detroit on the global stage. Most importantly, however, was the negative effect on the economy. Following decline in the population, Detroit's tax revenue took a significant hit. The government was receiving less revenue, leading to foreclosure and unemployment, eventually culminating in the bankruptcy. Detroit's population is still declining today, largely due to its majority poor and black demographic. Because urban renewal, highway construction, and discriminatory loan practices contributed to white flight to the suburbs, the remaining poor black population resulted in a loss of revenue. Furthermore, Detroit has the highest property tax of any major U.S. city, which makes it difficult for many families to live in the city. Seemingly contradictory are the extremely poor services in the city the city has. Dilapidated schools, lack of safety, blighted properties, and waste contribute to the lack of family living in the city today. So that's the story of Detroit now, its decline, what caused it. You could talk about it being a company town, not being able to adapt to new economic circumstances, corrupt municipal government, maybe greedy unions, greedy corporations, the big three being lazy. Detroit, what's your take on poor old Detroit?
Well, I think the best book read to understand what happened to Detroit is The Slaughter of the Cities by E. Michael Jones. Mm-hmm. And the best way for any of our listeners to get to, you know, quick understanding of the book is the interview you did with E. Michael Jones, which is absolute classic. And, you know, you didn't get a chance to do much talking with E. Michael, but the questions you asked were absolutely the right ones. And so he really goes into Detroit. He explains basically that the destruction of the city was social engineering. No real question about it. He goes into the characters who actually, you know, were responsible for the maneuver, the social engineering maneuver that was the turning point of the city. I mean, if you look at the city, you know, we talked about our topic being the rise and fall of Detroit. And actually, it's very interesting because it did have like an apex and then a decline. It's very, very easy to trace demographically, economically, crime everywhere. It occurred sort of, the apex was basically the period right after World War II. And then maneuvers started to, you know, were brought against the city with the idea of the social engineering. And what E. Michael Jones points out is that it was the Catholics in Detroit, the Catholic communities, that were really the problem. And this was why they decided to implement what Jones calls social engineering against the city. So during World War II, the white workers were gone fighting. And so they decided they would bring in black, underdeveloped, undereducated individuals. This was how they were characterized, to basically do labor in Detroit. And they decided they would use them also for social engineering. So the ostensible reason that they were going to help with, you know, manning the factories was how they explained it to the public. But once they got them there, you could see that they had another purpose for it. So what happened was, is they put these projects, which would be basically warehouses for these individuals, right? And they put them right in the middle of Catholic communities. Now, this was done with a very deliberate plan. The idea was is to make it undesirable for these communities to stay put and to eventually have them leave, which is what they did. And when they would leave, then you would have an end of the basically of what they were concerned of, which was the you know, kind of the coherency of the of these ethnic communities. Now, it was a long process, and Jones, you know, incrementalism. Think of like my take on the Nazi Party, of how long that took, and how Helen Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society was involved in all the aspects of it. Well, in the destruction of the Catholic power in Detroit, which was the turning point for the whole city, Jones starts out with the Blanchard brothers, but the what was really the problem was more closely defined by Louis Wirth. We'll go into him in a second, but I just wanted to read this is from Louis Wirth's paper that he wrote trying to explain to the U.S. government why we had to break up these cities. In other words, what Wirth went after, there was a race war riot. The race riot was caused by this insertion of the black projects into Corktown, which was the area that the Irish had lived for 100 years.
This was 1943, right?
Yeah, that's right. This riot occurred in 1943. And so Wirth went there and he wrote a paper and he said, you know, the relative internal unity of the Catholic groups in the urban centers increases their capacity to act collectively and to develop an appropriate group consciousness. Just read it again. The relative internal unity of the Catholic groups in the urban centers increases their capacity to act collectively and to develop an appropriate group consciousness. So whenever anyone asks us, why exactly was the social engineering developed against these groups? Thank heavens, Louis has helped us with a very clear answer. That was why. Okay, so now there is incrementalism involved, and it's fascinating to me in both in his book and also the interview you did with E. Michael Jones. He starts out talking about the Blanchard brothers. Okay, now the Blanchard brothers were propagandists. Who basically in the 1920s attacked the Catholics in the United States on all kinds of grounds and for all kinds of reasons. And basically what they were saying is the Catholics have too much power and they are very, very dangerous, right? Just as Wirth had pointed out to the government that there were four dangerous ethnicities, you know, that wouldn't Americanize. You had to be very worried about it. And he said they were Italian and German and Polish and Irish.
Incidentally, Wirth was an agent for the Office of War Information, I believe, right?
Right, of course.
And OWI, yeah. So he's that's a psychological warfare office during the Second World War.
That's where it comes from, exactly. Yeah. It comes from the one that actually starts with Creel and then morphs into what Louis Wirth then came out of when he comes and does the investigation and brings back the idea that these four particular ethnicities, that they're dangerous. And now Brand, and this was in the 20s, and this all kind of links together. You have to give me a little rope here because I actually this is quite interesting to me. So Brand, he wrote that, he goes, he's talking about the Catholics, and he had done that. Now, he went to Philadelphia. He actually went to Detroit as well, but he comes back.
You mean Blanchard?
Well, Brand, there was two. There was Paul and Brand was the name of this guy. Paul and Brand Blanchard.
Okay, oh, I see. Okay.
They were fraternal twins, and they are, you know, the two that Jones focuses on because he picked up on the incrementalism.
That's right. Because Paul's the better known Blanchard.
Yeah, that's right. But
because he wrote the book Catholic Power.
Right. That's why he's better known. But actually, yeah. Brand is actually. Very, very important too. And Brand was a Rhodes Scholar of all things. But I mean, okay. Well, it gets worse. But let me just. So what Brand wrote? He said they had gone together, the two of them. They had a grant that E. Michael points it out in the interview. But anyway, so they went there and they came back and they said, you know, these Catholics. And this is what he wrote. He goes, it's a world, talking about the Catholic parishes. It's a world which is simply not our world. A world in which independent criticism and disinterested science is and must remain unknown. A world which still abounds with the primitive concepts and fancies of the Middle Ages. Wow. Now, this is quite amazing because I actually went in and got some demographic results of like the Catholic parochial school system in Detroit. And you won't believe it. It was like the top-rated schools of the city. And so somehow, I don't know how, God, you have to, you know, like they went in and they saw that basically they were middle-aged peasants that, you know, couldn't even like, you know, use flush toilets. But the data is exactly the opposite. The Catholic parochial school system was the very highest rated school system in Detroit. So this, it makes really no sense, but it doesn't really matter because it's okay. So anyway, the fact that Brand, you know, that this guy is coming as a Rhodes Scholar is a red flag. Cause as you know, we've seen that the Rhodes Scholarship is so often used as by, you know, oligarchic shills. So this is kind of a bad deal. Now, Louis Firth, who is the sociologist they sent there, now he's from B'nai B'rith. Yeah, he's a big B'nai B'rith guy, and he's the one who's there saying that these ethnicities are dangerous to America. He was also the president of they always give these guys titles. He was the president of the International Sociologic Association, and is also president of the American Sociologic Association. I mean, wow, but what a guy, right?
This also is contemporaneous with the publication of the American An American Dilemma.
Yes, of course, yeah, right? Yeah. So it's all coming up. Yeah. Well, anyway, so now you have the Rhodes Scholar, the B'nai B'rith guy. B'nai B'rith guy is coming from the Office of War Information, which was established by Creel and Edward Bernays, right? Creel, of course, ends up in the Bohemian Grove. He lives out his life. He doesn't even leave the building, you know, so he's just 100% secret society guy. Now, and the last guy I'm going to mention before I'm going to move on to this other subject is that people don't kind of remember this guy, and I don't think Michael Jones mentioned him, but the real villain in this whole thing was George Edwards. Now, George Edwards is regarded as one of these WASP guys who unified with the Jewish people to like go against the Catholics. You know, it's this idea of like, it's not some kind of racial attack against Catholics because both the WASP and the Jews are in opposition to them, right? Now, Edwards is the arch-villain because even though, you know, Firth and the Blanchard brothers had set up kind of the intellectual structure which would lead to the social engineering of just planting these poor black guys in the middle of Corktown, which was the Irish, you know, historical Irish area. And as I said, it was 250,000 they had to warehouse. So it's just this enormous demographic bulldozer to get the whites out of their enclaves. But as Jones points out, he goes, you know, it was really mysterious because there's all kinds of land, even though Detroit had, you know, industry and all this stuff. Detroit had just incredible open spaces. I actually was in Detroit a couple of years ago, less than 2 years ago. And I was, you know, it's, you have the ruin porn in your face. You know, mm-hmm. you have these incredible classic buildings that are just, no one lives in them. You know, they're just falling apart. But you also have huge open spaces and park. There was tons of places to place the black workers, right? They could have set up these projects. Oh, just anywhere, 20 miles of area. But no, they planted them for the social engineering purpose. But the guy who did it was George Edwards. George Edwards. And he is a famous Freemason. So now that it all starts to kind of, you know, rough pattern work together here. You've got, you know, B'nai B'rith, you know, working with this Freemason guy. There's the Rhodes Scholar who's coming out of the Bohemian Grove organization, right? So what I'm saying is that the social engineering has a secret society component, obviously, in back of it. And I think that E. Michael Jones makes a huge mistake when he doesn't go into these backgrounds. He just sees this triangle of the WASP elite and Jewish sociologists and things, Jewish money power, and then the Catholics as the third component, and it's, you know, it's two against one. But I think if he would just spend a little bit of time and go into the background of these guys, he would see that no, it's not really two against one. That these, you have the asterisks, I call it, you know, where you have the secret society membership of the supposed WASP, you know, the WASP, you know, like guys who are supposedly joining with the Jews. But to me, this is like Palmerston, like his idea of that now is the time for the Jews to return. This makes no sense. I mean, he's an Anglican, right? Well, it makes perfect sense if you think of him as the head of the Freemasons, and that Freemasonry has some kind of real strong genetic links into Judaism. Now, last week I mentioned, I'll shut up here in a second. Last week I mentioned that there's a kind of DNA, you know, you get this sort of, no matter what they call themselves, Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, you know, all of these different secret societies, they have this DNA where you always have a promotion of Zionism. You have a hatred of Catholicism. You have 100% of, birth control. You know, these things are all, in terms of population reduction of the Gentiles, these things are always in play, no matter what they call themselves. And so I just wanted to point out that Blanchard had written, I'm sure you know, but in his work on the Catholic Church, Blanchard had basically, he said that, he says that they have too much freedom, these Catholics. And so he said, well, what we need, and he actually listed a whole bunch of things. I this is kind of a long list, but there was a few things he wanted to change. He said that, he says the Catholics need to begin to disseminate birth control information. They need government control on sex and venereal disease. They have to have abortion in all cases, anytime medical opinion decides there's danger. They need sterilization to be an approved medical procedure. They need absolute exclusion of all religious education from public school. They have to agree to this. He goes on and on. He says that, they have to give up their ability to, like, defend on moral grounds anything to do in movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's got this program for the Catholics that's, well, I mean, basically it's slavery. It's just, you know, it's complete. Give up everything you believe in, all of your faith, and
all influence on society.
Right, and all influence on society. And this is now here's what I found about Blanchard. This, remember I said about the DNA. You know, you always get the DNA, and I was thinking about Blanchard. You know, I mean, what the hell is this guy? Well, I found this little article he wrote in the American Jewish Chronicle. He wrote it in gee whiz. This is like a hoot. Yeah, I think hopefully this will cheer you up. He wrote it in November 1918, and he wrote it basically two Jews, right, because he wrote in the American Jewish Chronicle, and he was writing in favor of the League of Nations. He was saying that the League of Nations is really, really important. We've got to support the League of Nations. And he says, Jewish people, I'm going to quote, he goes, Jewish people have more than ordinary interest in the nature of the peace settlement. That's the League of Nations. He goes, the problem of Palestine is not merely a problem of purchase and material reconstruction. If Palestine is to become the Jewish state of the future, it must belong to a brotherhood of nations pledged to observe international law. I'll just read that again. This is written, now bear in mind, this is written in 1918. The Jewish population in Palestine is like 4 or 5%, right? I mean, it's they have the Balfour Declaration, but I mean, what is Blanchard referring to here? He goes, if Palestine is to be the Jewish state of the future, it must belong to a brotherhood of nations. Okay, so remember we talked about the DNA about Zionism. Well, here is this, I mean, Blanchard has a, you know, kind of rags to riches, kind of strange background, you know, but here he is suddenly, he's talking in 1918 about Palestine becoming the Jewish state, right? Very strange. But there's a great conclusion. Now he says at the end of it, he goes, it's going to be a problem to get the League of Nations put into effect because we have to wipe out all sovereignty. And he says, we're going to have to do it. We're just going to have to do this. He goes, through cooperation with similar societies abroad, its work, and that means the establishment of the League of Nations, has been extended to almost all of the nations of the earth in an attempt to prepare the mind of all races and people for the new international order. So this is 1918. He's talking about they are preparing the minds of all races and people for the new international order, which will be the League of Nations. My favorite part is he goes, the Jewish people have reason to stand with the League of Nations movement. Think of the millions of Jewish sons who have been sent into battle against one another in the Great War. Wow. You know, there was a few Gentiles actually, weren't there? I mean, think about that. He goes, we are resolved this shall not happen again. Nationalism has been too often the misfortune of the Jew, but the internationalism of President Wilson has made this war supremely worthwhile. Now, okay, next sentence. Now, remember, 1918, he goes, out of it shall come a new world order in which Jew and Gentile shall breathe alike the air of freedom and peace. Right. Okay, so, I mean, out of the war shall come a new world order. I don't know. And then he talks about the Jew and Gentile shall breathe the air of freedom and peace. Well, wait a second, Tim. Didn't we just go over his list of freedoms for the Catholic?
Yeah.
Where they have to permit censorship of every single thing, sterilization has to be, I mean, that there is, they can, they, there is no, there is like in his program for the Catholics in the United States, they would basically have to just give up their entire spirit and intellect in order to go along with what he's advocating. But now, you see, this is amazing, Tim, because he's replicating the same thing. This DNA just keeps popping up over and over again where, Palmerston, and I was going to say, there's one other aspect to the DNA I want to mention. I noticed I was actually, it's hatred of the Irish. That's also something that they all have. Palmerston, remember, he sent all of his Irish slaves. He sent them in across the, you know, because they was costing him money since there was nowhere. They couldn't eat enough food. They couldn't produce anything. So he kicked them out, threw them across the ocean. Most of them died on the trip. And they actually had, they have like cemeteries to these people. If you read the letters where Palmerston is talking about the Irish, he's talking about them like they are basically animals, right? That just they can do whatever they want with these slaves. But he also said, now is the time for the Jews to return to the Holy Land. Well, think about Blanchard here. I mean, he's supposed to be, has this Christian background, you know, who knows what it really means. He's a sexual libertarian. Mm-hmm. But in any case, but he also has this weird parallelism with Palmerston, where suddenly the Irish people are really bad and need to have all kinds of controls put on them, if not just genocided. But the Jewish people will be somehow singled out, and the League of Nations will create a new world order in which the Jew shall breathe the air of freedom and peace, and that the minds of all races are being prepared for this new international order. So anyway, so this is, to me, this is very relevant to Detroit, because I think you can see that the Catholics, these Catholic enclaves, were really the focal point. This is what they went in and took out. And from that point, when they started to drive them out, the city then just came apart at the seams, because the blacks that who had now were becoming, you know, more and more the majority, had absolutely no background in the kind of functions of government, right? Remember, they were coming from the poorest parts of the South. They were the poorest of the poor. They were still under a system of slavery. We could do a show on that sometime, of the how they kept them as slaves after the slavery, the, you know, you had the amendment, but they had this kind of indentured situation where they could keep them, you know, basically either in chain gangs or slaves. So these guys who brought up, they came up with every hope of getting out of the hell out of the South into something better. And they did. For them, it was a better situation. But they were used for, unfortunately, for the social engineering, which then, you know, busted up these neighborhoods, created the white flight, which you well documented at the beginning of the show. And then basically now has led to a situation where, I mean, well, it's part of what led to the situation where Detroit is ruined.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, Blanchard, I think he would, 30 years later, in the late 40s, he read a book called Catholic Power and American Freedom, where he pretty much said that, you know, Catholicism, or American Catholicism, at least practiced traditionally, was incompatible with American liberty. Then juxtaposed to that is his, you know, proposals for all types of coercive measures against Catholics, denying them, you know, influence in the in public policy or in society, imposing birth control and sterilization. And of course, these things couldn't really be imposed overtly in the United States. These things would have to become accepted. And this was achieved by psychological warfare, which by the mid-20th century had become really sophisticated. So part of that, of course, was moving them out of the neighborhoods, creating suburbia, so they'd become deracinated, and they'd become, you know, white middle-class Americans, where they would embrace pornography, contraception, effectively sterilization, and that's what, you know, homosexuality is a lot of that too, because it's basically sterile sex. What E. Michael Jones says is making sure that everyone thinks like a homosexual, at the very least, when it comes to matters of sexual, they engage in meaningless, episodic, sterile sexual relationships. So they were, by denying them their community, their roots, they would become sort of these sexual robots that Blanchard wants them to become, because they're subjects for the American Empire, which was the objective in the middle 20th century for the Cold War. But it's interesting, you know, so when you read, you know, his Blanchard's grandiose ideas about the New World Order and, you know, emerging from the Great War, how, you know, with such great ideas, you could see how he would think very little of the integrity or the sovereignty of these communities or these neighborhoods, you know, for such big plans. And Detroit was put on the chopping block, as were many other cities. Philadelphia, you know, is another one. Baltimore,
there was large Catholic enclaves, they specifically sought that those groups out and wiped them out.
Yeah, I mean, you could see with the Germans and the Italians, you know, ostensibly, you know, these, you know, they're the enemy, right, during the Second World War. But the Irish, the Poles, you know. I suppose what he says about them being medieval, meaning they're not willing to, you know, to embrace contraceptive contraception, and that's, I guess that's medieval in his mind. But Detroit, again, so this is the pretext. This is the time, the 1940s and 50s, when social engineering is being really geared up in the United States. And I mentioned this is 1940 is when the book An American Dilemma is published, written by Meyerdahl, Gunnar Meyerdahl, who was a Swedish sociologist who went back to his home country. But people most likely think it was ghostwritten by sociologists coming out of University of Chicago, which is a Rockefeller outfit. But I think it was Gunnar Meyerdahl who said in a speech while he was touring America then that Americans in the future will not be allowed to decide on their own where they want to live. This was a big part of social engineering. And the pretext of the war, you have the labor shortages, so they ship up the blacks from the South and they inundate these traditional Catholic ethnic neighborhoods and they create these race problems, the one being in 1943. But there are others throughout in other cities too. And that's what Louis Wirth has brought in to investigate. You know, they said Louis Wirth was an agent for the Office of War Information and also B'nai B'rith. So in the 1950s, I guess the 40s and 50s, you have these landmark Supreme Court decisions, Brown versus Board of Education, desegregation, integration becomes sort of the agenda. And this is kind of what happens in Detroit in the 50s and 60s. And you have this, I think going into the 1960s, Detroit was like 83%, white and 12% black. And then by 1980, it was majority black. And by 2010, it's like 10% white and 84% black. And this coincides also with the decline of the city. There are some other things going on too, of course, as you had, the growth of the American auto industry and America's industrial heyday in the mid of the 20th century. A lot of that was it a product of also the Second World War, when American primacy was established. All the industrial nations of the world pretty much have been, either severely damaged or flattened by the war. So U.S. became the only power in the world with an industrial base and the capacity that was left unscathed, and you had this post-war prosperity. There is some issue, was that sort of artificial at the time, the sort of golden era, or was it deliberate policies? Some people attributed to Fordism, idea of high wages, sort of industrial growth. And if you can chart when America was industrial and agriculture, its prosperity could be found in the Midwest, and as it became more financial in the latter half of the 20th century, the financial sectors became dominant, and sort of the industrial managerial areas went into decline. And you also, in the latter half of the 20th century, you have American industry, particularly the American auto industry, being confronted with fierce competition abroad, particularly from the Japanese, but also from Europe too. And so a lot of the big three, some would say, became complacent. They also, the big three was forced to diversify and start to move. One of the things how Detroit was designed is because of the interstate highway system, highways, they started to disperse the auto production first in the outlying areas in the suburbs, then into the South, as that was a source of cheap labor. But again, because of the demand for labor, wages were high in Detroit, and they brought in cheap labor, which is an old trick. And so that cheap labor started to pour in the 40s and 50s and 60s. So you had the demographic changes in Detroit. Now, it's interesting. Some people cite the decline of the auto industry and sort of the economic problems in the 1970s and stagflation as a reason for this. But there are areas around Detroit, like the Oakland County and Grosse Pointe, which would have had to dealt with these setbacks, but they've done very well, and they're very white. It's only in Detroit, where it's majority black, where they haven't been able to adjust to the new environment, and you've had municipal governments that have proven to be very incompetent or corrupt, and so what's going on here? Is it the decline of the economy, or is there something else going on here? You had Coleman Young's administration in the 1970s. He sought to diversify the government. He started an aggressive affirmative action program, hiring program. This in the when the city is suffering rapid decline. And as a result, the city government becomes very corrupt and incompetent. This also aggravates more white flight out of the area. And then you have the phenomenon of white flight is the reality is when you inundate these areas, these ethnic neighborhoods, these white ethnics don't want to be there anymore. They want to deal with the problems. And as you know, this isn't something, they call it white flight. White flight sort of blaming the victim, you know, as if this is a white thing, you know, it's some sort of, it's a reaction to something. Well, it's a reaction to high crime and other things that may, violence that makes living in the city, unpleasant, if not impossible. So they leave and they want to go establish a neighborhood, you know, establish a neighborhood community where they're around like people. That's what, that was what happened in and around Detroit. But of course that was the plan with integration was first bring in these people come in to, you know, from the South to work and then integrate the neighborhoods. The planners wanted white flight. They wanted the creation of suburbia. And suburbia is a big part of this in the decline of Detroit and many other cities. But it created that atomization and that deracination that we see now, which is also prevalent, you know, in 21st century America.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's very little that is not part of an overall plan. They certainly, you know, it's when you look at Louis Wirth's program, right? Is you can see perfectly well that there is like an overarching program here. They're trying to drive away these communities and put them in areas where they're going to be busted up, and so. It's just this a very long process. And, you know, and there was like 10,000 whites left a year between 64 and 66. And then you had the race riot in 67. And then so then 47,000 left that year. And then the next year it just collapsed and 80,000 took off in 1968. So this was if you overlay those demographics with great society largesse, they're basically completely correlated. So what was happening is they were bringing in the blacks, they were setting up the welfare state, and at the same time they knew perfectly well that they were letting in the Japanese cars, right? So yeah. There was going to be less work. And so what have they done? Well, They have established basically a community inside, you know, an old established city, which can only exist by the largesse of the government, by the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of a new form of slavery that's being created through maneuvering out productive people, putting in their place individuals who are not educated, who don't really have a way to defend themselves against these kinds of techniques, right? And are going to always look to the paycheck in the mailbox for, you know, because that's what else is available to them, you know. I mean, one of the problems I see is that people target the wrong enemy in this. You know, they say, well, these blacks are on welfare. You know, they came into the neighborhood. It's the blacks are the problem, right? It's the reason that the blacks came into that specific area that was the problem. It was the people who designed the program.
Well, I mean, it's an understandable thing because blockbusting, the whole strategy was that they'd get black kids to knock on the door to say, hey, your neighbor just sold a house to a black family. Do you want to put your house up for sale? And this was a scam because what happened with these people doing this, they caused white flight. People would sell their house at a cheap price. Then these real estate agents would come in, many of whom were black, would come and sell it to wealthier blacks at a high price.
Sure.
I mean, it was a scam. But, I mean, from the standpoint of the person on the ground, it does appear that way. And it is, you know, at least superficial, at least, you know, on the ground.
The fact is that when you look at the statistics, the whites who left were absolutely right. I mean, the blacks who came in were far, all of the kind of fear statistics, they were far more likely to commit murders.
Yeah.
They were far more likely to commit rapes. They were, they were just a frightening group. It wasn't like some kind of pastoral people, from Finland came, and I mean, these were people who had come from very difficult and violent kind of lives in the South, and you put them there. I mean, it was, this was...
Well, we talked about this when we talked about the Moynihan Report.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is that then you had the Moynihan Report. He saw where this was all leading. He was, and his report was kind of a, the watershed moment. They could have, if they chose, they could have gone to continue the improvement of all of the statistical, positive aspects of the African-American community. They could have done that. It would have been trivial. But no, they knew what they were doing when they went away from Monahan's suggestion and went a Great Society full throttle. Husband has to be out of the house for the check to come in. Mm-hmm. The public schools are just completely underfunded. Not that they could have done anything anyway, really, because there was just this enormous cultural gap.
But at the same time, you have the hypersexualization of culture at the time, too.
And of course, pornography is coming up. So they're creating, basically it's the Epsilon and Delta class, which will now be, you have that's in the inner city, which will now, they'll be the, the neurologically diverse, autistic individuals who will be moving in shortly. I mean, this is, these guys just have the most.
Well, if you blame a situation in Detroit, there's two culprits or people, two things that get the blame for this. It's either racism or, big liberal government.
Yeah.
Okay. We get blamed. Now, the problem with that is the same time that they're blaming racism, they're decrying white flight. But if it's white racism is your enemy, then why do you want to live next to them? Why do you want to be among them? They're talking about the declining tax base. You're admitting you need white people productivity to live. At the same time, you're decrying their racism. There's a contradiction there.
Well, I mean, the thing is that the blacks, think about what they were like from the educational perspective when they were brought into Detroit. I mean, they were basically illiterate farmhands.
So if you got this cult of equality, egalitarianism, this program for affirmative action, if you start hiring people who are less qualified for city government, you're going to have a lower quality of services, much higher corruption, because now it's race-based. And then you get the reputation for government, the municipal government of Detroit, and being anti-white and corrupt, and that's what happened. Because you've got this arbitrary idea of equalizing, where you're not dealing with the underlying issues to begin with. To attain anything close to economic and social equality, it's going to take generations, and you can't accelerate it through social engineering.
You have to work toward the goal, not away from it.
And you may never get there, because it may not be.
Of course, it may not even be possible. But the thing is, you can certainly get better every single year. You can have a legitimate program to work for it. But taking all these people, sticking them, using them for social engineering, it's just cruelty and evil on a mass scale.
It's like
and
busing.
It's kind of parallel to in a strange way. It's kind of like the lesbian transgender group today. Mm-hmm. Where they have this idea that they are victims and that, and they actually kind of parallel the civil rights movement, in terms of their thinking and vocabulary. And then it would never occur to them that what they're really defending, what they're really seeing heroic, is toxicity. Mm-hmm. Because that's how their sexuality was destroyed, and damaged. And they are the result of a deliberately toxic culture and toxic effects on their DNA, so that their hormonal system is wrecked and they end up basically either a lesbian or a homosexual man. Mm-hmm. And they would never think that there had been a kind of weaponization of culture and food and everything else to produce them. You see what I mean? It's just the blacks have the same thing, is that they make heroic all of these aspects of the toxic culture that they have been subjected to. And this is where I just think it's just tragic.
You blame, blame racism. That's easy to do because the optics are there. The narratives are there. But all of a sudden, you have, you know, equal housing laws passed and all these civil rights laws are passed, and the situation just gets worse. So, okay, so what's the problem? Then they say, well, it's liberal policies. Okay, I can understand that. You have governments that aren't friendly to business, high taxes, highest property taxes in the country, and no one pays it anyway, so you have tax avoidance. And just, you know, at the same time, they're spending a whole lot of money on you know, on pensions and swollen government payrolls and these things. It's just, it's a basket case. You know, they just don't, you know. But the problem, and you know, there's always corruption in any municipal government, Chicago and these things, but there's corruption that works and there's corruption that doesn't work. You know, and so, you know, like Chicago, you know, under Daley, it worked kind of just as corrupt, you could argue, but more sophisticated. But in Detroit, you take a city like Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is very liberal. If you look at, I think they pay more, they only wear more welfare and all that stuff, but it's not black run, and it runs reasonably well, where at Detroit, it doesn't. So it's not just liberal policy, just the quality of the people running the government. And there's a when you create this crash program, you have this demographic warfare, and you have you know this rapid changeover in demographics in the makeup of the city, and this changes the politics, and all of a sudden who's staffing government agencies, you're gonna have a drastic shift in the quality of services and the loyalty and how it becomes very tribal, and that's what's happened in Detroit. I mean, if you look at I believe the highest, if you look at the city, the highest crime rate for a white majority city has one third the crime rate than the lowest crime rate for the majority black city. So, yeah, so you have this outrageous crime rates. So there's you're dealing with a problem, not just of municipal government, but also a cultural problem within America's black community about, you know, basically, you know, a lot of things. When you have an illegitimacy rate, out of wedlock birth rate of close to 80% now.
Oh, it's more in most inner cities.
Yeah, in inner cities, it's close to 100%.
Far, yeah.
And so, yeah. You're going to have that, when you have that much chaos in that community, you're not going to be able to have anything close to anything of a functional municipal government, which you don't. That's why every municipality that's majority black or black run is a basket case fiscally. And also,
let me ask you something though, Tim. Okay, so could anyone be capable of having a functioning culture if the anthem music that was played around the clock was gangster rap?
No.
I mean, it's impossible. Yeah. But who owns all of the labels? Oh, my gosh. Very few blacks, you know. And and so this is the thing, is that then look at pornography. This has just been like a plague upon the African-American community. Well, did they create that? It's sort of like the cocaine epidemic. These guys, they were targeted because they had, particularly, think about in like the 1930s. I mean, their culture didn't, there was no culture.
Mm-hmm.
People were being brought up. There was a slave culture, but they didn't have any power or control. They weren't involved in any kind of administration policy. I mean, they were slaves. And they were still slaves in 1930. The idea that they'd been emancipated was nonsense. Look at the indentured servant rules and laws and things that they were still living under in like the 1910, 1920. Mm-hmm. So they were, in my opinion, these guys are thinking long term. They know where it's going to, they know what these people are going to end up doing. They are going to be the social engineering tip of the spear, you know, because when these guys come up and they put them in Corktown, and just imagine Corktown, it's just literally a pristine middle-class community with almost no violence, very high educational level, in spite of what the middle age, you know, phenomena that the Butcher brothers saw. Very, very high educational level, very high standard of culture. And you're bringing these people who are really, you know, lower in terms of culture than the people that came across on the boats from Africa. They've been absolutely focused upon in a negative way. And then you insert them right into Corktown. I mean, this could only be done for destructive purposes. It has there's no conclusion to it that can be anything other than what I saw when I drove through Detroit a couple years ago.
Yeah, and you can look at black sort of lumpen proletariat. They can clear real estate.
Yeah.
In a generation or so, and then they can come in, and then it can be later on be gentrified after the prices have plummeted.
Well, I mean, like, if ever, they have to basically restructure the whole culture in the area. They have never reversed any of the social engineering which is being done in the Great Society programs. All of those things are still going full mm-hmm. throttle. Every single program. It is just such an incredible outrage that when they have absolutely destroyed a culture that and are destroying, you know, the European culture now as well, that there isn't, you know, riot.
Well, I mean, Detroit's just a great case because in Detroit, the civil rights activists got exactly what they wanted, right? They got access to a white area. You got all the protections, the city run government run by blacks, employment opportunities, everything, and the city collapsed. How do you blame racism for that?
Well, that's right. It could only collapse if it had been attacked specifically. Mm-hmm. Because remember, you know, the quotes from the Brand, you know, about the Catholic Pharisees, you know, it's not our world. Mm-hmm. In a world which independent criticism and disinterest in science is and must remain unknown. And of course, you know, Louis Firth, where he goes, you know, the Catholic groups in urban centers increase their capacity to act collectively and develop an appropriate group consciousness. Well, look, there's the problem. And that was attacked.
Yeah. And again, the ugly truth is you have to address if you're dealing with inequality and crime and all these things, you have to deal with the reality, the differences within these different communities. If these problems don't come from problems within the black community, high crime and blacks, you know, they're competent, they're smart, and they're, you know, there's no problems, they can be employed and all this, they should be involved in academia, employed with corporations, become our sports heroes, entertainment communities, you know, and we should have no qualms about integrating and living amongst them. At the same time, if you look at, you know, predominantly black areas or by any metric, they're in terrible shape. How does one?
Look, the whole thing is preposterous. Yeah. I mean, they talk about, you know, this integration. It's like this model, this multiculturalism.
Why is that the default position? Why is that a priori the morally superior position?
Well, but also, I mean, Louis Firth should have been, you know, like spending his whole life trying to fix problems in Palestine.
Yes.
Well, come on, Louis, get over there. You know, you're a sociologist. Work out these problems. I mean, here you have a terrible situation. You're having a genocide of these dark-skinned people. And where are you? Where is the honest, you know, kind of application of the philosophy everywhere? So, and when you read like Paul Blanchard's insane comment about the New World Order and the Brave New World, and you know, like the League of Nations mm-hmm. is gonna, like, we're gonna get in the minds of men, you know, and stuff, and he talks about Israel as the future state of the Jews. Where is the concern for the humanity of the Palestinians? Where? I mean, this guy is supposed to be this big, you know, he's a big humanist guy. Where is it? Where is the? It's like literally to him, they don't even exist.
Well, when you're thinking in such grandiose terms, you can't worry about such a small group of people.
Yeah, and so that's the thing is that the American blacks they've had this treacherous, you know, hand given to them, which looked like the hand of help, but actually it was the hand to like take them into the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's why when you go through these things, and when I was in Detroit, it's just, you know, it's hard to describe. It's just this, it's a ruin, but the people are in just, they are in, you know, the misery there is just so high. When I was in Cuba a couple of years ago, I met this guy, Nam, and he's a black guy. He was there studying kind of local crop growing kind of micro gardens, you know, in Havana. Mm-hmm. And he just says that Detroit, he was from Detroit, and he says, you know, the problem, he says, is that people don't have any nutrition. He goes, all they have is the SNAP card, which gives them Coca-Cola and corn chips. And he says, you know, there's just obesity, diabetes, you know, and of course it rots your brain out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then there's the vaccination schedule is on top of these poor guys. I mean, it's just, so that's the thing is that one of the, you know, things we've talked about a lot is that you've just got to, when you look at this evil, how organized it is, how basically it's heading toward this technological world dictatorship. I mean, the first act of rebellion is inside your body is you have to say, look, I'm not going to let the toxicity exist in there. It's the toxicity in the inner city in Detroit. I mean, and by that, I mean, inside, you know, the bodies of these people is really the final kind of act of this whole social engineering, because it transitions from social engineering into physiological engineering at a certain point. And that's where they are now, where they're developing, you know, the autistic, the you know, the mentally feeble, the transgender. You know, these are sex toys for the oligarchs in the future.
Yeah, and the addiction on prescription drugs Americans have.
Oh, yeah, which we talked about last week.
Yeah, just to cope. Not just extreme pain. You know, I'm not talking about a burn victim or someone who's suffered a serious injury or operation. I'm talking about people who take these things just to cope.
You know. Oh, I'm telling you, you'll need opiates to cope with the kind of misery that I experienced when I drove through it.
But the background of all this is social engineering, which is, you know, I think in itself illegitimate. It's coercion and needs to be exposed, because with social engineering comes psychological warfare. And this is where this is what the civil rights movement, this is integration is about and all that. It's denying you the rhetoric and the logic to combat these things, because now it's no longer accepted as morally defensible to preserve the integrity of an ethnic neighborhood, of a certain white ethnic group or something. That's racism, you see. It's racism. Whereas no one thinks, you know, twice about black neighborhoods. The idea is that you can't have freedom of association if you have this extreme egalitarian look or worldview. And the idea that though our social engineers, our betters, can use the power of the state or even now corporations and foundations or NGOs to manipulate society, to move people around, to disrupt that society, to create sort of discordianism in society, is obviously they've been doing that for decades. And they did that in Detroit, and they've done it in other cities, and they're still doing it today with weaponized immigration or migration. Communities no longer have the ability to defend themselves, and with that, you know, because that's illegal. The Supreme Court ruled in Shelley versus Kramer that you couldn't have restrictions, restrictive covenants on properties. But this is a way of maintaining an ethnic balance, an integrity to a community. Of course, it's pathologized. But we're seeing now just how important some of these protections are. The ability to voluntarily associate, and also to exclude too. That's the other side of that. But that's normal. You know, point of
it's absolutely essential.
Yeah.
To maintain ethnicity, which, by the way, has been the foundation of our existence for thousands and thousands of years. And so we want to at least analyze any going forward without it. I think it's really useful to go through stuff like this. You know, it is useful to talk about Louis Firth and to talk about the Blanchard brothers, incrementalism, you know, how they plant these ideas. But it's really important to like point out how they are using propaganda. When you read Blanchard's, like his little article, which is in the November 1918 American Jewish Chronicle, Volume 5, you know, and he writes, you know, that the League of Nation has been extended to all nations in the attempt to prepare the mind of all races and peoples for the new international order. Well, gee whiz, did all races and people vote to do this? Did we really want to? Gee, okay, let's do that, you know. And then he talks about, you know, and then you have the Sophist where he talks about, you know, out of it shall come a new world order. I mean, this is just incredible that he would have the vocabulary in 1918, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Already have it, already, which the Jew shall breathe air and the freedom and all the blah, blah, blah. But this is the same guy who's got a list of requirements, basically full spectrum dominance for the Catholics.
Yes.
So
it reminds me of Benjamin Ginsburg's book, Fatal Embrace, about the Jews.
Yeah.
And he saw in that book, he admitted that the Jewish support for civil rights and integration was a cover, or at least a pretext to pursue their interests, because they would use the same logic and reasoning for what he considered liberation, emancipation of Jews within the host society, to remove restrictions confronting them. Not just legal restrictions, but also psychological restrictions. The awareness of society had that this was an alien group that needed to be monitored and controlled and not give them, you know, full access to society, because they take it over. But he admits this. Yeah. And so now,
Kevin, he does, because that's a point where people can actually,
yes,
it all kind of will gel in their minds.
But when they talk about basically all races or ethnicities are being erased away, we're all become world citizens. But there's one group that doesn't think that way.
Right. And that's why, you know, you look at someone like Louis Firth, and you know, he's the president of the American Sociologic, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, this is at the time when the state of Israel is being established.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the, he presents this argument.
The Jewish state's being created. They're talking about doing with nationalism.
The Jewish state is being established. And so you can see that, you know, this new world order that he's talking about, right, that this worker's paradise, this is the biggest bamboozle bait and switch I've ever seen in my life. If he had those beliefs, if they really were sincere to him, or Blanchard, or Palmerston, or any of these people, they would apply also to the people who are the real residents of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's why the Palestinians are they are critical people at this point in history, because what is happening to them is going to happen to us. You see?
Well,
this is the future, because they are basically the canary in the coal mine, as far as, you know, how when they talk about, you know, how the minds of all races and people for the new international order have to be prepared. Man, it's grim. They're definitely the people who have those beliefs are really into world dictatorship. You know,
and now, you know, even suburbia is on the chopping block here in Virginia.
Yeah, I was reading about that. Yeah.
Democrats seek to race outlaw suburban single-family housing zoning, calling it racist and bad for the environment. This is Daily Caller, December 23, 2019. Democrats in Virginia may override local zoning to bring high-density housing, including public housing, to every neighborhood statewide, whether residents want it or not. The measure could quickly transform the suburban lifestyle enjoyed by millions, permitting duplexes to be built on suburban lots and neighborhoods previously consisting of quiet streets and open green spaces. Proponents of upzoning say that changes are necessary because suburbs are bastions of segregation and elitism, as well as bad for the environment. The move, which aims to provide affordable housing, might be fiercely opposed by local officials throughout the state who have deliberately created and preserved neighborhoods with particular character, some dense and walkable, others semi-rural and private, to accommodate people's various preferences. But Democrats tout a state-level law's ability to replace "not in my backyard" with "yes in your backyard." House Delegate Ibrahim Samira, introduced six housing measures on December 19th, coinciding with the Democrats' takeover of the state legislature in November. Single-family housing zones would become two-zoned, Samira told the Daily Caller News Foundation. Areas that would be impacted most would be the suburbs that have not done their part in helping out. Jeez. The real issues are the areas in between very dense areas, which are single-family zoned. Those are the areas that state is having to significantly trouble dealing with. They're living in a bubble, he said. He says suburbs are mostly white and wealthy, and their local officials, who have historically been in charge of zoning, were ignoring the desires of poor people who did not have the time to lobby them to increase suburban density. In response to a question about whether people who bought homes in the spacious suburbs have valid reasons not based on discrimination for preferring to live that way, including a love for nature and desire to preserve woods and streams. He said, caring about nature is very important, but the more dense a neighborhood is, the more energy efficient it is.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy.
So there you go. I mean, yeah. You can't get away from it. They can't get away from us.
No, they just, but this is really,
That's obvious. That's social engineering. You dump a public housing unit in the middle of a neighborhood like that. It's gonna, yeah.
Well, but they're not even, I mean, like I was actually fascinated by that article. I read it earlier today because of the, you know, how apt it is to our discussion mm-hmm. about Detroit. Because really what happened to Corktown is basically now they're talking about micro Corktowns, because what Samara is proposing is that, like, lawns that people have. He's talking about upzoning to the point where, so if you have a big lawn, well, they could put like a little low-income housing project on it. that's what this is. And yeah. don't make any mistake about it. This is what he's saying. He's saying, you know, we in order to make it more, you know, like environmentally friendly and get rid of the people resisting cultural Marxism, they would create zoning so that, and you know how it would work. You couldn't resist it, right? If someone, you know, there would be like part of like a, they would upzone the whole place, and mm-hmm. and the town would have to have a quota for how many new, you know, like lawn condos that they were permitting. And every one of these lawns on a block would be required to put a condo up, which would then be low-income housing. So you'd have, and you see, I mean, this is completely insane. It shows that, I mean, basically, this guy Samar he's been his marbles have been shaken loose by cultural Marxism, yeah. Because all this would do would be to drive the property value to zero in these areas and just move people a few states over, because they could never, no one in a middle class community would let a a low income condo be built on a lawn that they owned. It would just be, you know, that, and so there it is. And this may seem,
well, I mean, some of these affluent communities let Yonkers, New York, submit to this back in the 80s. So this is what you get when you know. The problem with there's no white solidarity, because it doesn't exist, because high-income whites want nothing to do with middle or low-income whites.
Well, look, I'm willing to do my part, Jim.
I mean,
if you want to build a low-income condo here in my property, you know, I'll find. But I want to see, you know, like the same thing take place in Israel.
I just want to
see, you know, come on, let's everyone, you know, let's all pull together here and try to help one another. We can't have, this is sort of like the transgenderism, you know, it's like the cutting edge. It's a little avant-garde. It's really not real at the moment. I mean, I'm sure this will probably be, shot down. But yeah. you can see that this is the future. This is actually what's going to happen. Is there won't be, the white people will be restrained by both zoning and law, probably, from any kind of exclusion. It'll all be defined as racist.
Yeah.
Every kind of attempt to just keep, you know, like a world in which most of the people you associate with are your same ethnicity will be against the law, mm-hmm. and physically impossible, because they'll just zone it all out. So, you know, this is what happens when you don't have the right kind of political organization and you don't know how clever the attacks are that are coming against you, you know. And so hopefully we can reverse this, because I, for one, am perfectly happy to live in my, my own little home. And so I don't really need or want, like, someone to build a house right on top of me.
Yes, yeah. Nor do I want to be enriched.
Yes, that's right. I'm perfectly willing to like suffer with my, you know, my own little cultural isolationism here. So. Oh boy.
Okay, Joe.
Hey Tim. Yeah, it was good talking to you. Well, we'll get them next week, buddy.
Great. Happy New Year then.
Happy New Year to you. Bye bye.